All right, welcome to our Parsha class tonight, where we'll be discussing the significance of the city of Hebron. We know Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. What about Hebron? What is its status? What is its significance? Of course, we're talking about it because this week's Parsha, about half of it's dedicated to Abraham purchasing the Maranach Pilah, the tomb of the patriarch, whatever the exact translation of that is, we'll get to later. But that tomb in Hebron, he buys that field and that cave from Ephron for 400 silver pieces, which is an enormous amount of money. For instance, a slave, I hate to use this expression, but that's something I'm going to reference. A slave could be bought for 30, an able-bodied slave could be bought for 30 silver pieces in those days. So we're talking, it's more than, what is that? 13 slaves could be bought for that price. It's a very, very high price. For this cave. So it leads us to the question of what is the significance of Hebron in Jewish life, Jewish thought. So we'll be walking through the Tanakh, we'll be walking through the Middle Ages, and let's take a look. So let's get started. Let's get ripping and roaring. Here we go. So the significance of Hebron. we're going to see there's the hill, there's the valley, where is Hebron supposed to be? And we'll talk about that later. But you see it's on a hill. This is the hilly part of Israel. If you look last week's Parsha, Lot was told to go to the mountains, but he said, no, I can't go to the mountains. He wanted to stay on the plains where the Sodom and Amorah, where the Dead Sea is. He didn't want to go to the mountains. But most Arabs in Israel live on the mountains. That's where the action is. That's safe. It's safe up there. You can hide on the mountain. I don't know. It's cooler up there. It's hot in the Middle East, right? So Hebron is no different. It's not one of those cities that's on a mountain range. And if you find the right path along a straight line on the mountain range, you can walk all the way from Beersheba, down where Abraham likes to hang out, up to Hebron. And then you can pass my yeshiva. Har Etzion is also the Gush Etzion area. It's also on that mountain range. And you go up straight, and then to Jerusalem. And you can keep going up all the way till the Jezreel Valley. Then there's a break. The valley is a break. And then there's the Hermon Mountains and other mountains up there. In any event, what's the significance of Hebron? Let's take a look. So it's called the Kiryat Arba. It's also called Kiryat Arba. Today there's the city of Hebron, which the Arabs call something that they do. The Arabs use the word Yadid. I forgot the first word. It's like something Yadid, the beloved of God, the beloved one. Abraham is buried there, so they call it something to do with Yadid. But the Jewish city today, aside from those who are willing to live inside the Arab city of Hebron, the Jews live in a place called Kiryat Arba. But in the Chumash today, this week's Parsha, it says Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, which is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So Kiryat Arba, the city of four, something like that, is one of the names of Hebron. And here it's referred to as the main name, which is also Hebron. So what does that mean, the Kiryat Arba, the city of four? For what? So let's look at a number of different commentaries, and it begins to bring us into this question of the tomb of the patriarch, etc. So Rashi says that literally it's a city of four. It's called because there are four giants who live there. It says in Numbers, and Visham over there in Hebron are the following four people: Achiman, Sheshai, Talmai, Yilidei Hanak, the children of the great giant, whose name is not mentioned, but you have three giants and their father, who no doubt must have been a giant. So that's why it's called the city of the four giants. We know that in Israel is known for its giants. Here was one of the cities that the Jews visited when they were talking about the giants with the spies, and it has giants. Another explanation is that it was so called because of the four couples who were buried there. Man and his wife, Adam and Chava, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah. Unfortunately, Rachel didn't make it, but Jacob and Leah. So you have four couples. Now, of course, why is that a hard interpretation of the previous verse? Sarah died in the place of the four, and it means the four couples. Why is that a difficult interpretation?
But she wasn't part of a couple?
No, she was. So they're buried. Yeah, but Sarah was buried in the place of the four couples. What are the four couples? Oh, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah. Make sense? Do you see the chronology? Right? It's out of sync. You can't call it Kiryat Arba yet. The four couples weren't buried yet. But in any event, it's an interesting interpretation. Arba, Ibn Ezra, is not such a midrashic kind of person. He's going to go with the simple meaning, the literal meaning. He says, I think Arba was the name for, Arba means four. But he thinks that that word is actually the name of the biggest giant. Now, then some people say, well, who the biggest giant is? Abraham. That's why it's called City of Arba. He says, no, that Abraham was not a giant, maybe a spiritual giant, but he was not a regular run-of-the-mill giant. The Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, says that he can prove it, that there was a guy named Arba, because it says in Joshua, Kiryat Arba Avihanak. It's the city of the four of Arba, who's the father of the giant. So his name is Arba. It's strange, but that's what it is. Kiryat Sichon. There's a city of Sichon who's a giant. So you could have a city of a guy named Arba. So it's strange, but maybe his name is four. Rav Sadegon was one of the earliest commentaries on the Chumash. He lived before Rashi and the Rambam. And he said that there are four explanations for the city of four. He says, number one, there was a person named Arba. Next, maybe it was the four giants, Achiman, Sheshai, Tamai, children of the Anak. Then he has his own unique interpretation. He says there are going to be four groups who will own this city, not including the Arabs and the Turks and all that. The tribe of Judah, and we're going to get into that, Hebron and the tribe of Judah are very much connected. We'll get to that later. So the Levites, because it's one of the cities of the Levites, belongs to the Kohanim, to the Kohanim, because it's a city of refuge. It's one of, if you kill somebody by mistake, you run to Hebron. And the fields are going to belong to Kalev. We're going to learn about Kalev, one of the two good spies. And he's rewarded to be sort of the mayor of Hebron. And so the four groups of Jews, Judah, Levites, Kohanim, and Kalev, they own this city. They're responsible for the city. And then, of course, you have the more pedestrian Rashi explanation that the four couples are what it's talking about. And, of course, it doesn't say anywhere that Adam and Eve were buried there, but you wonder, why was Abraham spending so much money? Let him buy a different cave. If this one costs 4,400 silver pieces, let him buy another cave. So apparently he knew something special about it, and maybe he knew that Adam and Eve were buried there, or something even more special we'll get to later.
And then animal wandering.
Yeah. We'll get to that. Very good, very good. We'll get to the animal story later. I just want to leave it for the end. It's very good. Excellent. Ashira is jumping to the end. The
Sorry.
Punchline. No, it's good. It's good. Now, the Debs Vyachman was a rabbi in Germany, and he said, even Moshe's uncle is Hebron. If you look at the family tree, you know, we sort of fall asleep when the Torah starts going to family trees. One of Moshe's uncles is Hebron. Amram Yitzhar. Amram is Moshe's father, is the oldest. Yitzhar is the second one. Hebron and Uziel. So Hebron was one of the names. So in Egypt, some of the people named their kids Hebron. So apparently it was a word that was in the mouths of the Jews even before they came to Israel. They like to talk about Hebron. They remembered Hebron. And that's the proof that Hebron is a very special place. He says, in the mouths of the Arabs today, it's called Al-Halil. What does it mean, Al-Halil? The place of the beloved one of God, which is Avraham. Well, the Arab names are always interesting because they tell us a lot about Jewish history. And he says, maybe that the word Hebron is similar because Hebron is a chaver, yedid. Yedid, Khalil, Al-Halil means a yedid, it means a friend. But chaver is also a friend. Yedid is just a fancier word for chaver. Everybody knows chaver. Bill Clinton knows the word chaver, right? So chaver is friend, but yedid is a fancier word. You may know some kids named Yedidya, means beloved of God, the name of Solomon. So maybe that's why Hebron is called beloved. Maybe it has to do with Avraham. Although this story is told that Avraham, that the city was Hebron already, even before Avraham got there, unless what it means is Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, which is what it was called then, which is Hebron, which is what it's called now when Moses is writing, because Abraham already lived. That's another possibility.
This was a natural cave. Nobody dug this cave, right? It was just
right. We'll get to the cave itself toward the end. Yes, thank you. Now, moving along in Jewish history, when does Hebron come up again? Kalev. Kalev had a special affinity for the city of Hebron. As follows. They all went through the desert. The 12 spies went through the desert. They went through the Negev, the desert, and then they went up to Hebron. And but it says he went to Hebron. No, they all went through the Negev, the south, but he came to Hebron. So Rashi says Caleb alone went there and prostrated himself in the graves of the patriarchs, offering prayer that he might be helped not to give way to the enticement of his colleagues. He knew that the spies were going to say bad things about Israel. He didn't want to be swept away with the frenzy of the spies. He prayed not to join their council. You may see that it was Caleb who went there. How do we know this? Because indeed the scripture states in Deuteronomy, because Caleb, son of Jephunneh, he shall see it and I will give him the land. And it says that, what land did they give Caleb? They gave him Hebron. So apparently when it says he came to Hebron, it's only Caleb. Caleb alone came to Hebron. And here's an idea, a rabbinic midrashic idea, that you should pray to God at the grave of your ancestors. We don't pray to Abraham, but we do pray to God at the grave of your ancestors. In the merit of the ancestor who's buried here, you pray to God. So there's a tradition that Caleb did that. And eventually in Joshua, the book of Joshua, he's given the land. Some say he was given the field. In the Chronicles, it reviews the story and says that he was given the field, not the whole city. Now, we're talking tonight about Hebron, so obviously, you know, the rabbi wants to say that Hebron is the best city ever because that's why you came to this special class about Hebron. But Rashi says, actually, it's the worst city, but it's still a great city. He says, the Torah says that Hebron was 7 years built before Tzoan in Egypt. Now, so Rashi makes a whole complicated calculation that there, one of the children of Noah was Ham. And Ham had his oldest son was Egypt.
Was the what?
Ancestor of Egypt. Was the ancestor of Egypt, Mitzrayim.
That's what I thought you said.
Yeah. And the younger son was Canaan. And so Soan is older than Hebron. And yet it says that Hebron is seven times better. That's how he interprets the verse. Seven times better than Egypt. And we know Egypt is like a garden of God. So Hebron is seven times better than so on. But Hebron is the rockiest part of Israel. He says that why do you think you don't bury someone in the best land? You bury someone in a rocky ground. Look here on the side. It says indeed, they set it apart for the place of burial. There's no rockier ground in Israel than Hebron. If you come to my yeshiva, which is only 7 miles from Hebron, you'll see that it's all rocks. When they first founded my yeshiva, and the whole area with the kibbutz Kfar Etzion, they literally had to clear rocks from the mountain, which is just all rocks. Underneath is beautiful soil, but it's very rocky. So it's not the best of land, but it's still beautiful land. We know you can grow wine there and all kinds of good things. Originally, it was a field. There were a lot of fields there today. Where there used to be fields, today is the city of Hebron. Moving along. So it's not our best city, but it is still a beautiful city. Better than Egypt. In Joshua, it says, there's a little story about Caleb. Let's read that just because it talks about Hebron. So the Judahites approached Joshua at Gilgal, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, whatever that means, he said to him, "You know what instructions the Lord gave at Kadesh Barnea concerning you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I gave him a forthright report. I gave him a good report. While my companions who went up with me took their heart out of the people, I was loyal to the Lord my God. On that day, Moses promised on oath, the land on which your foot trod, which we interpret to be Hebron, shall be a portion for you and your descendants forever, because you were loyal to the Lord my God. Now the Lord has preserved me as he promised. It's 45 years since the Lord made his promise to Moses. This was journeying, and I'm 85 years old today. Wonderful. And I'm still strong today as when Moses sent me. My strength is the same now as it was then, for battle and for activity. So assign me this hill country, the mountain we showed you before is a mountain, as the Lord promised on that day. Though you two heard on that day that the Anakites were there in the great fortified cities, I said that we could dispossess it. Don't worry about it. So Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, Joshua was also one of the good spies and assigned Hebron to him as his portion. But again, later it says, elsewhere it says that he just got a field. And therefore, Hebron belonged to Caleb to this day because he followed God. So there's an idea that Caleb was given a special inheritance, and somehow that's a big deal. To get Hebron is a good catch. Interesting. Okay. Then we move on to the next biblical character, very, very important, David and Hebron. We see from David that Hebron is very key and crucial. It was later on. David said to God, should I go up to one of these cities? Now that Saul is dead, King Saul is dead, should I go to one of the cities? So Hashem says to him, through the breastplate, they had a way of communicating through the breastplate. It was sort of like a Ouija board type of thing. And the breastplate said, Ela. He says, where should I go? So Vayomer Hebron, the official oracle said, go to Hebron. Hashem told him to first go to Hebron before anything else. So David went up from there, along with his two wives, etc. David took two men from there. His family settled in the town of Hebron, and he was anointed there in Hebron. So the question is, why Hebron? Why did David pick Hebron? Now, if you picture Jerusalem being the northern border of Judea, of his tribe, it's the border, Jerusalem borders on Benjamin. And if you picture Beersheba being the south, Hebron is equidistant between Jerusalem and Hebron, if I'm not mistaken. I used to know the exact miles. I think it's 7 miles to Bethlehem, 7 miles to Hebron, and then another number of miles down to Beersheba. But in any event, it's sort of central before getting into the really deep desert kind of thing. You don't want to go down there. And apparently for Judeans, it was very key. So some of the commentaries, medieval commentaries, they ask, you know, why Hebron? So so he says as follows. I'm sorry, the translation is not correct. God chose that David should go to Hebron to show him that from there the kingdom would flourish beautifully. And there you find that as soon as David came there, the people of Judah themselves came and they anointed him as king. And it could be, he says, it was a political thing. It was a blue state or it was a red state, whatever you refer to it as. It was a state that would follow Judah, that was very Judea loyal. It was David loyal. Remember, he went to this other fellow, Nabal. He wasn't loyal. But these people were loyal to him more than the other ones. Now, David was from Bethlehem, which is only 7 miles away. So that explains that a little bit. So he's sort of a, what do they call it, a favorite son. And it's as if he expected that when David came there, they would help all the Judeans appoint him as king. So he had a sense that it was good, core territory. You want it, your base, right? You have a political base. The Judean base as a Judean king would be from Hebron. From there, eventually he would move to Jerusalem to move his capital to Jerusalem. And eventually the men of Judah came and they anointed David king over the house of Judah. David was told about the, etc. So he was anointed there in Hebron. That's where he was, the first king of Israel was anointed in, not Jerusalem, but Hebron, because it was so Judean, the center of Judea. Now, in general, there's a Ramban theory that had Saul not sinned, he would have been king of the north and David would have been king of the south and his capital would have been Hebron. Jerusalem is more of the capital of the whole country, but the capital of Judea was, at least originally, it was Hebron. Now, the next time we meet Hebron is in the story of Avshalom. Avshalom is the no good, nudnik, despicable son of David who kicks out his father and takes over the throne. Okay? But he is quite a politician. He's got beautiful hair. He kisses all the babies and the women. Everybody loves Avshalom. He's got the best deal. He's going to be the best for you. He's going to help you. He's going to help everybody. Terrific politician. And he kicked David out of town. And until they had a civil war, and Avshalom eventually dies and he's killed. But after 40 years, Avshalom said to the king, when Avshalom was still getting along with the king and the king was suspicious of him, but he was still letting him roam around, he said, King, I want to go to pay my vow, which I made to God in Hebron. Now, this is very strange. You're in Jerusalem, but you want to pay a vow to God in Hebron. Why? So it's possible that they, in those days, Jerusalem was not yet picked as the ultimate city of the temple. There was no temple. David did not build a temple. Solomon did. So it was in the intertemple period, you're allowed to bring sacrifices elsewhere. And for some reason, he wanted to bring the sacrifice in Hebron. He had promised God he would bring a sacrifice in Hebron, which tells you what? That Hebron was a holy city. It was a, if you wanted to bring an offering at certain points, you would go to Hebron. He says to his father, Avshalom says, I made a vow to when I was in Geshur and in the, up north, I said, if God will bring me back to Jerusalem, I'll worship God. Where? In Hebron? So apparently Hebron is viewed as some kind of a holy city. But why Hebron? So actually, it was just a trick. He wasn't bringing any sacrifice. He wasn't so religious. He wanted to go to Hebron to anoint himself as king, come back to Jerusalem, take his father out, and take over. So why did he pick Hebron? So Rashi says, oh no, the rabbis say he went to Hebron to bring lambs, to bring them back to Jerusalem. So Rashi's a traditionalist. He can't imagine someone leaving Jerusalem to bring sacrifices in Hebron. It's like today, so Jerusalem to go to Uman in the Ukraine for Rosh Hashanah. And some rabbis pull their hair out. They say, how can you leave Jerusalem? So the Rashi says, oh no, he just went to get, they have good sheep over there. It's good grazing territory. And these little mountains, the sheep can eat whatever the stubble that grows there. They're Barbanel. Sorry, my connection's a little loose. I hope we don't lose the connection. The Barbanel says, he figured David anointed himself. David started his career in Hebron. So I'd be successful too if I start my career in Hebron. He wanted to go ask God for help. So maybe he was praying, maybe he was religious, maybe he wanted to go pray to God to help him in his new plan. And if David was successful there, he would be too. Another commentary says that Barbanel said,
was Absalom power crazy?
Oh, yeah. He was power crazy. Yes, absolutely. He was a very terrible, a despot type of fellow, a real trickster, slick. So Barbanel says something very important about Hebron. Here you can look at the Hebrew. He says it was Ir Va'im B'Yisrael. This is the most complimentary thing you can say about a city. It is a city and a mother in Israel. It's like one of the mother cities. It was a city of kingship where you make the kings. He thought just like they'll make him king over there. And he sent messengers from the whole world, the whole country, to accept him as king and to follow him. And the Radak says the same thing, that since his father became king there, he thought so as well. So somehow there's an idea that you start your kingship over there. David did it. Avshalom did it as well. Okay. And he said, send messengers to declare that Avshalom became king in Hebron. If you're king in Hebron, you're in good shape. Again, that's the base. Then you got your Judean base of your friends, your tribe. And then from there, it's easy to get the other tribes, easier to get the other tribe once you excite the base at over there. Now let's take a quick break. We're going to jump to the medieval travelers in Palestine. And Benjamin of Tudela, here's a translation of Benjamin of Tudela. There are streets in Israel named after him. He's one of the few who recorded what it was like in Israel in the Middle Ages. I think he lived about the 1300s, something like that. At a distance of 6 parsangs is St. Abram Dibron, which is Hebron. St. Abram. The Christians, when they were there, the Crusaders, they called it St. Abram. The old city stood on the mountain, but is now in ruins. So the original city was not in the valley, it was on the mountain, but it's in ruins. And in the valley, by the field of Machpelah, lies the present city. So the city now is in the valley, but the valley was supposed to be the field, not the city. You always have your city. So where the city's crops used to be. Here there's a great church called St. Abram, and this was a Jewish place of worship, the time of the Mamadian rule, but the Gentiles have erected there 6 tombs. I guess he was there during more of a crusader period, respectively called those of Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah. So he's probably referring to the chambers that we see today when you go as a tourist. We have someone on the call with us today some people today who are going to tell us about their trip where they got exclusive tour. When you go in the plane tour, you go to these rooms and there's the tomb of this one, tomb of that one. I think he's saying, I admit I'm not an expert on this, but I'm just a little research I did, that when you go to those rooms, those are rooms that were set up by the Christians in the tomb of the patriarchs, in the building that Herod erected the building. But, and that was 2000 years ago, but in the Crusader time, the Christians set up these rooms that they said were the rooms of the patriarchs, and then the pilgrims would give them money. If a Jew comes and gives a special reward, meaning money, the custodian of the cave opens up to him a gate of iron, which is constructed by a four low by me. I'm sorry, I didn't take a picture for this occasion, holding a lighted candle in his hand. It's very dark. It's a real cave. You asked before, Charlie, is it a real cave? Yes. And he then reaches a cave in which nothing is to be found, and a cave beyond, which is likewise empty. But when he reaches the third cave, behold, there are six sepulchres, tombs, those of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, respectively, facing those of Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah. And upon the graves are inscriptions cut in stone. This is the grave of Abraham. This is the grave of Isaac. It says it in Hebrew that these are the graves of each one. The lamp burns day and night. The graves filled with bones of Israelites. Jews would decompose somewhere else, let their ancestors or their parents decompose, then they take the bones, put them in a clay vessel, and put them next to Abraham. Who wouldn't want to be buried next to Abraham? So there are a lot of bones there, and deposit them there to this day. Okay. So that's what Benjamin of Tudela says around 1300. The Rambam also lived in Egypt, but he visited Israel, Palestine, and he said, on Sunday, the 9th of Cheshvan, which is just about a week ago, Amanti Mara, I stood in the cave, and I prayed. Shevach la'el yiparach alakol. He prayed, thanks to God for everything. Now, Darti, I vowed, Shuli kamo yontav, that day when he came to the tomb of the patriarch should be a yontav, should be a holiday for him. Tefillah, a day of prayer and simcha, great joy, eating and drinking. Kim yazvini alkol, I hope I could fulfill this vow to continue to celebrate this day as the amazing day when I came to Hebron. He was very moved by Hebron. Ovadia Bartanura was originally from Italy. He also visited in the 1500s, and he wrote, I went to Hebron, and I lived there a while, until the point where it was living there was so beloved to me more than Jerusalem. Why? Because he said the people in Jerusalem, they weren't also not there. There were some bad people there. But over here, there were 20 families, and we lived in a little ghetto. It was closed. No Arabs were allowed to come in. There was a tradition that it was better to be buried there than in Jerusalem. Okay? And there's an old building here from very big stones. Right? He doesn't know about Herod or anything. But we know that the Tomb of the Patriarchs that we see today is built by Herod the Great in 2,000 years ago, before the temple was destroyed, the same guy who built the Kotel. Very weird and negative character, but he was a good builder. And he sees these buildings are humongous. It's unbelievable how big these stones are. They're the same stones from the Kotel, same type of thing. And then there's another building that there's stuff that the Arabs, the Muslims built, the Ishmaelim built there as well. So that's the Rambam and the Rav Avadia Bartanura, the rabbi from Bartanura, who comments on the Mishnah. Okay. Now, jumping way ahead, we have on the call today some of the Sheinberg family. And we'll talk about, there was a victim from Memphis. The Sheinberg family will discuss in a moment. And in 1929, it was a great massacre. Somehow, there were some nice rabbis here in town, and there were some boys who became very interested in Judaism. One was Abba Engelberg. He became a rabbi, and he became a big rabbi in Cleveland. And his good friend, Aaron David Sheinberg, they grew up here, and they became very interested in learning Torah and following all the mitzvot. And we'll talk about him in a moment. And so Aaron Sheinberg, their family had the Sheinberg stores and were able to send them to Israel. And he went to Columbia, and he had some money, and he was able to spend some time there in the yeshiva. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But unfortunately, he was killed in the massacre of 1929. A little blurb from the massacre in 1929. This is, I'm not sure, this may be colored in a way that's not so politically correct for us as Jews, but the Wikipedia story of the massacre. It says the Hebron massacre forced the killing of 67 or 69. Now notice the headlines in the New York Times are 47. That was before they counted all the dead. On August 24th, 1929, in Hebron, then part of Mandatory Palestine, by Arabs incited to violence by rumors that Jews were planning to seize control of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Again, is it proper to mention the excuse of why they killed men, women, and children? But in any event, the event also left scores seriously wounded or maimed. Jewish homes were pillaged and synagogues were ransacked. Some of the 435 Jews who survived were hidden by local Arab families, although the extent of this phenomenon is debated. So I don't know whether that's true or not. Soon after, all Hebron's Jews were evacuated by the British authority. There's a fellow here in town who claims to be from a family of people who helped Jews during that time. Soon after, all of Hebron's Jews were evacuated by British authorities. So this is a particularly egregious thing. Jews lived in Hebron. We showed you they were living there in the times of Benjamin of Tudela. And they were living there for centuries and centuries and centuries. Maybe a small community, but we had a presence there. The British decide, the Arabs are getting upset. Take the Jews out of Hebron. And that's a great travesty. And that's why Jews are motivated to live there. They say, ain't no British people going to tell us we can't live in our city of our patriots. And people are dedicated. People are willing to live constant conflict in the city of Hebron itself or very nearby in the Jewish settlement of Kiryat Arba.
What year was this they were talking about this?
1929 is the massacre.
Oh, okay.
1929 is the massacre.
Well, on both sides?
Soon after all of right. Many returned in 31, but almost all were evacuated in the outbreak of the 69. Was there violence on our side? Not at this 29, no. 29, we were not, there's no violence on our part. Jews were starting to come to Israel's nascent Zionist movement by 1929. Of course, 1881 was the first official Aliyah. There were different Aliyot, different groups of Jews who come from Eastern Europe and other places. And the Arabs were getting nervous. So, but there's no excuse. They massacred men, women, and children. And the British thought, let's just get the Jews out of that city. So the massacre formed part of the 1929 Palestine riots. 33 Jews and 110 Arabs were killed and brought the centuries-old Jewish presence in Hebron to an end. I don't know about the Jews being killed. I can't vouch for any of the words in this paragraph, but more or less gives you a sense of what happened. Now, thanks to the Shamrug family and Rabbi Vroom, we have several representatives here, Cindy and Jill, maybe some others. And thanks to Rabbi Mails, a local rabbi, he took some of these letters and put them in an article in Tradition. And I just want to share with you a few little statements that he made. The yeshiva itself is a revelation to me. So he was in Hebron, in the Hebron yeshiva. The Hebron yeshiva. So it was one of the, like an Eastern European style yeshiva where people were learning all day. But it was in Hebron. Litvish yeshiva, I think so. And it was in Hebron. There's still a Hebron yeshiva, but it's in like B'nai Brak, or I think there's one in Jerusalem. But there's a Hebron yeshiva today, but it moved to Jerusalem. But at this point, it was over there. So he went to stay to go to the yeshiva. There were a lot of great rabbis teaching there. The boys surely fall far short of the popular conception of the yeshiva bachur. They, for the most part, are neatly and modernly dressed, although a bit shabby, of course. In manners of deportment, they are perfect. The yeshiva is insistent upon a high standard of etiquette within the yeshiva and outside as well. The character of each of the 200 students, that's a lot of students, is of the highest imaginable. Now, there would have been a lot more children killed had it not been the break. August 24th, it's a break. After Tisha B'Av, it's customary for yeshivas to be closed. So that's why he was from out of town. So he got stuck and got killed. But thank God, a lot of the students were on vacation. Even I was surprised at what I found. The student body is composed of the purest types of idealists. There are both married and single men ranging the age from 20 to 60. Already ordained rabbis sit and learn all day and support themselves in teaching the younger students. All in all, I thank God every moment of the day that he brought me to the yeshiva here in Hebron. Here, not only can I best acquire that knowledge which I seek, but I'm thoroughly Jewish atmosphere on holy ground. And you, my dear parents, only pray that you should always be as happy as I am at present. May God bless you with continued good health, peace of mind, and that happiness which comes from good children. I don't the serious tonight, perhaps because it is past midnight, I'm writing by lamp night light, I am brought to a more serious frame of mind. So leave off, etc. Very touching letter, and eventually he is killed. Sends them more and more ever in your mind and heart here in Palestine. You would think that familiarity would wear off the enthusiasm, but it does not. Quite the contrary. And especially are you in the state of constant inspiration here in Hebron. Just think, here within 10 minutes of a walk is the cave of the Machpelah, where the Arba Zugos, the four couples, he writes in Ashkenaz, lie buried, Adam and Eve, Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah. In the Zechus, in the merit of the patriarchs, we live under divine light and protection. History has it that such as the Ramban, Baal Reshis Chachma, and others also laid to rest here in Hebron. Since Jewish tradition tells us, and here we get to that point that Shir was hinting to at the beginning, that the resurrection will begin here. When the resurrection of the dead takes place, first the people in Hebron will come to life first. Therefore, Abraham named the place Hebron, meaning the joining, which he interprets as the reuniting of the body and the soul. That's the chaver. Chaver means lechaber, is to connect. It can be friendship. It could also be reuniting the body and the soul. When the resurrection of the dead takes place, the reuniting of the body and soul will take place. So some sentiments from this Aaron David Sheinberg, whose cousins are on call tonight. And we'll call on them a little later to tell us a little bit about the family experience and also some of their Hebron experience.
How far Jerusalem was from Hebron? Hebron from Jerusalem?
I think it's 14 miles. I think 7 miles to Bethlehem. Oh. 7 miles to Bethlehem. It's a 5 minute drive. And then another 7 miles to Hebron.
Okay.
And
okay.
Between
okay.
Hebron and Jerusalem. And yeah. Because my yeshiva is in there as well. Okay. Now, why is it called Maarat, the cave of Machpelah? What is Machpelah? What does that mean? So the word kefel means double. So it's called a double cave. So Rashi says, Bayit Vali Agabah. It must be one story and another story. So I don't think that's supported by current stories of people who've been there. Another explanation of why it was called this is because it's characteristic of being double on the account of the couples who were buried there. Because we mentioned the couples, Abraham and Sarah, Adam and Eve, Isaac and Rebecca. It's Shadal, who was an Italian professor, Italian rabbi, a scholar in 19th century. He says it's just the name of a place. Machpelah doesn't mean double. It's just the name. It's the cave of Machpelah. It's just the name of a place. Rashbam, by about 700 years earlier, said that the whole valley is called Machpelah. There's Kikar Yarden and there's Marata Machpelah, the cave of the valley. The cave of the valley. That's what it means. That's the Rashbam. And Ibn Ezra, who always looks at the simple meaning, he says, Marata Machpelah, he agrees with the double idea. It's a cave within a cave. And that probably is probably accurate based on the stories we will hear. So let's listen to a story of someone who can tell us the story of those who have tried to go into the cave. Now, again, let's review a little bit over here. When you go to the Tomb of Patriarchs, so what you see is this. Now, it's a magnificent structure. I've learned recently that you see the top of this thing? That's what the Kotel would look like at the top. This is an unbroken building built by the same person who built the Kotel, but this one has the tops, and that's what the top would look like. The bottom would be the Kotel stones like the Kotel, and then the Kotel stones with a little decoration like that. And at the top, you'd have this. That's probably what the Kotel looked like at the top. It's unbelievable. So we can actually know what the Kotel looked like at the top because you look at one of Herod's buildings and you see that's what it looked like. When you go inside, now there's some caves over here, but then when you go inside, they take you to different rooms, and those rooms look like they may have been, maybe the church made these rooms and then the Arabs took it over and the Jews took it over, and they have monuments to supposedly Avraham Yitzchak, to the patriarch. But it's really down below this building, beneath the structure that Herod built 2,000 years ago, that's where the cave is, and perhaps a double cave. The problem is the Arabs control it to some degree today, and therefore it's hard to get down there and see it. So we're going to listen to somebody who's going to tell us about the story of those who have gone where no man has gone before. So let's take a look.
This is a memorial room for Isaac and for Rebecca. That room today is off limits to us. We have no access to that, excepting 10 days a year. I stress that they're only memorial rooms. Abraham and Sarah are not in that room, and Jacob and Leah are not in that room. They're in caves all the way below us. And what people, of course, are interested in knowing is where exactly those caves are. How could we access those caves? If we were to go into the big room, which today we don't have access to, the Isaac Memorial Room, it's a very, very large room, a very pretty room, a very ornate room. If we went straight in through here and turned right, a little bit off the wall is a monument. It's a brown monument with a dome up top. Four marble pillars come down to the floor, and in the middle of those pillars is a flower-shaped piece of marble with a hole in the middle. That hole goes all the way down into the caves of... When we came back here in 1967, then the defense minister, Moshe Dayan, wanted to know what was down there. The only problem was that that hole is about 23 or 24 centimeters in diameter. No normal person could get through it. So in October of 1968, he brought in one night a little girl. The little girl's name was Michal. She was 12 years old. And little Michal had two very important characteristics. Number one, she was very skinny. And number two, she was very brave. Because they brought her in the middle of the night. They threw everybody out. They opened the hole. They tied a rope around her waist, gave her a flashlight, and started to lower her down that hole all by herself, so that she could investigate and see what was beneath. You know, the truth is that for you to understand the significance of this story, I'm going to have to stop for a minute and give you an introduction. You know, we'll leave little Michal dangling for a minute. She'll wait for us. Let me go back a few hundred years. We're going back to the middle of the 1600s. This whole area was under the rule of the Ottoman Empire, the Turks. At one point in time, the Sultan from Turkey came to visit Eretz Yisrael, and he came to Hebron, he came to Marat HaMachpelah. He went into that room, and he was looking down that very same hole which was open then. Now in those days, of course, they didn't have Uzis or M16s, they had jeweled sabers. He had a sword attached to his belt, and he was looking down the hole, and the sword fell through his belt down that hole. And he wanted it back. He called over one of his soldiers and said, go get it. They tied a rope around his waist, lowered him down. He got to the bottom of the cave, at the bottom of that hole in a big room. All of a sudden, everybody up top heard this huge scream. They called him in and he didn't answer. They started to pull on the rope. They finally got him out. He was dead. They sent another one down and the same thing happened to him. A third one, a fourth one. Finally, the Sultan looked at his Arab host and said, what am I going to do? I want my sword back, but my soldiers are dying. So the Arab said, you know, there are Jews that live in Hebron. Let's send the Jew down. Who cares what happens to them? They went to the Jewish quarter just down the road. Now, you've got to remember that at that time, Jews were forbidden from coming in here. And they'd heard what was going on. They were petrified. The Arab comes in and says, who wants to go into Marat Machpelah? And they all said, thanks, but no thanks. So the Arab said, look, either you send somebody down, or else. So they said, give us a few days. And for 3 days they fasted and they prayed. And on the third day, the Arab goes back and he says, who's going? And the rabbi of the community says, me. And he wears all white clothing. They bring him inside here. They tie a rope around his waist. And they lower him down the hole. He gets to the bottom. He's standing in a big room. He looks around. And he sees standing in back of him an old man. He looks at the old man and says, who are you? The old man says, who am I? Who are you? He said, I'm the rabbi of Hebron. I came to get the Sultan's sword. The old man looks at him and he says, my name is Eliezer. I'm Abraham's servant. Wait, I have to ask permission if you can come inside. And he disappeared. And a few seconds later, he sees standing in front of him three old men. And he looks at them and he looks at them and he understands who they are. And he says, my fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, if you're here and I'm here, why should I go back up there? I want to stay here with you. And they said to him, our son, you have to take the sword back so they don't kill the Jews in Hebron. But if you want, you can come back next week. So he took the sword back up, and the Jews in Hebron made a big festivity out of it. He'd saved their lives. He spent that week studying with all of his pupils, with all of his students. Exactly 1 week later to the day he passed away, he's buried here in the ancient Jewish cemetery in Hebron. You're probably not familiar with such literature, but he's known as the Chesed Avram, Rabbi Avram Azulai. Very, very important rabbi. He was a great-great-grandfather of another very, very important rabbi, the Chidah. And that's the story of how he went down into the caves of Machpelah and met our forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now we come back to little Michal, the 12-year-old, who's dangling and waiting for me to finish the story. Everybody up top knew that story, and nobody had any idea what was going to happen to this little girl when she got down to the bottom. They lower her all the way down. She gets to the bottom. She finds herself in a big circular room. She looks around. To one side, she sees what look like three monuments on the wall. And this direction, though, she sees a tunnel, and she starts to walk. According to her account, she walks 17 meters. At the end of the tunnel, there are stairs. She goes up the stairs. At the top, it's sealed with a rock, comes back down the stairs, through the tunnel into the room, and they pull her out. And that was all they found. Now, we knew there was more there, but we had no way to investigate. And you will rightfully ask, why not? We'd come back, right? It was ours. Except that our old friend, the defense minister, Dayan, in 1967, when we came back, and the Mufti of Hebron came to him and said, here, now the keys to the holy place belong to you. Dayan said, what are you talking about? They belong to you. And he gave them back, leaving the control of this holy site in the hands of the Waqf, the Muslim Religious Trust. They decided who went where, when, how. We had no control over anything. However, people measured. This little girl said she had gone down the hole, she'd walked 17 meters. So we measured. People measured 17 meters from where she was in the direction she walked. And lo and behold, exactly opposite the monument here, with the hole in the floor, 17 meters away, on the other side of the hall, is another monument. The big difference between the two of them is that here there's a hole in the floor, and the other monument on the floor is an Arab prayer rug. And there's always somebody guarding it. We have no idea what's underneath that rug. And that's the way things remain for many years. We now jump from 1968 to 1981. 1981, there are people living back in the city of Hebron itself. People used to come down here to worship during the day and at night and for the holidays and before the holidays. Before the holidays of the Jewish New Year of Rosh Hashanah, people came down in the middle of the night to say special preparatory prayers for the coming of the new year. And they would come down in the middle of the night and pray. The Arab guards got tired of watching them. They have an office over here in the corner. They would leave and go to sleep. As soon as they left to sleep, somebody went over to that rug on the floor and picked it up. And underneath it on the floor was a piece of rock held onto the floor with nails. So a few nights later, they brought some tools with them. And when the Arabs went to sleep, they went to work. And after a little while, they were able to move the rock. And underneath it was a hole in the floor. They managed to get through that hole. They went down the stairs the little girl had gone up, through the tunnel, into the circular room where everybody had been lowered down. And they started to search. And at first, they didn't find anything. Now, one of the men didn't have a flashlight. He had a candle. And he was looking on the floor, and the candle extinguished. He relit it, again it went out. He put his hands on the floor, and he felt air coming up. If there's wind coming from underneath, there has to be something there. They started to push away the rocks, and that's when they discovered the entrance into the actual caves of Machpelah. They crawled in, they burrowed in on their stomachs, they found themselves in a large cave, they went all the way through that cave. At the end of the cave, they came to the entrance of the second cave. In Hebrew, the word Ma'arat HaMachpelah literally means double cave. They went into the second cave, and in here, much smaller than the outer cave, they discover two things. They discover remnants of pottery, and they discover remnants of human bones. An archaeologist later checks the pottery. He says it's not 3,700 years old. It doesn't go back to the days of Abraham. The pottery is only 2,900 years old, going back to the days of King Solomon and the Judean kings. When it seems that there was a custom that people would bring bones of people already deceased in these clay jars into the caves themselves.
So obviously some of the stories we heard have really sort of a, right, some of the stories have a very ancient sort of ring to them. They're told in the style of a lot of stories. It might remind you of the Rosh Hashanah story of, you know, you get 3 days to tell the emperor what you're going to do. But Rabbi Azulai was a famous rabbi. So I can't vouch for any of the stories, but it's interesting. There's some sort of cave. We have tonight with us some members of the Schoenbrug family, Jill and Cindy and Lisa. And I believe that you had a tour guide who took you to some sort of cave. Does it relate at all to what we were just talking about? Or is it not quite that deep?
Thank you, Rabbi. The man that was actually on your video, David Wilder, did take our family on a tour of Machpelah. He was our guy. And Cindy was, my cousin Cindy, who's on the call, was with us for my daughter's bat mitzvah, which was almost 10 years ago this summer. So that our family did go back to Hebron to find Aaron David's grave. And that was one of the tours that we went with David Wilder into the cave, into Machpelah. Yes.
Wait, so but you didn't go down a hole? I mean, how did you get
there? No, we didn't go into the hole, but we went into those rooms that you were referring to that were sectioned off. And they were actually part of them. We were not allowed to go in all of those rooms because, as you well know, they do share the cave of the patriarchs and matriarchs with their neighbors. So there's certain times of the day that Jews are allowed in, certain times of the day that Muslims are allowed in to pray. So our time was pretty limited in our visit. But David Wilder gave us the entire tour, and I've heard that whole story from him. So yeah.
Okay. Directly. There you go. Same source. Very good. And anything else you want to tell us about your, is it your cousin or is it a great uncle, Aaron Davis? So
Cindy and I are first cousins, and Lisa Kaufman, who is also on the call.
Yes, Lisa.
Hi.
Yeah, we're all cousins and we're all great nieces of
Aaron Davis. And I'm saying your cousin to each other.
Right. There were five siblings, and Aaron David was the oldest, who went to the Knesset Yeshiva in Hebron to study and was massacred when he was 23. So we're all the same relation. And at this particular point in time, we have an author that we have engaged, and she has access to the letters and the diary and the telegrams and telexes. And we are in the process of writing a book. So, and that's been a 12-year process.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Wonderful. Yeah. That's wonderful. It's exciting.
I'd love for my cousins to say something that are on the call.
Yes. Cindy, Lisa, feel free to chime in. Something about your
great
uncle.
You can see me. I don't have video access, but can you hear me?
Yeah.
That's okay. Yes.
I think, was it 2 years ago, we were in Israel with my parents, and it happened to be one of the days that Jews had access to the Machpelah. So we felt it was very important because we thought, you know, it could be one of the last times, you know, my parents might be in Israel, that we go there. So we contacted the Hebron Fund and made sure, you know, it was an accessible trip for my parents. It was very, very hot. I think it was around the anniversary of the massacre. So I think it was August. It was hot, and it was one of the days that we could go in, and we went, and I explained who my mom was, that she was his niece. You know, Aaron David Schoenbrug's niece, and you know, that they were older, you know,
niece, not a grandniece.
She's right. A niece, right, Jill?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Cindy. Our parents are nieces and nephews. Cindy's, you know, father, Jill's mother, and my mom are all first cousins, and their nieces of Aaron David Schoenbrug. So we went on the tour, and they took us through the museum and announced that my mom, you know, was a niece and had her speak about, you know, some personal reflections in, you know, in the tour in the museum. And they also had, you know, we had a private tour of, and went to the grave. So it was, you know, a very special time. And it was one of the, is it 10 days that Jews have access to that extra room and some of the places they don't ordinarily get to go?
That's what he said. Yeah, that's what he said, 10 days. I don't know which days.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, we should mention.
I think one of the, maybe Rosh Chodesh or I don't know, some certain days. Hmm.
We should mention just a full picture. One reason there's a lot of tension there, you know, certainly on both sides, there's no question about it. It's a very, you know, it's a very hostile situation. But there was, of course, a Jewish massacre as well, where a Jew doctor got up one morning and massacred a whole bunch of Arabs while they were praying. So it's also a very sad story. So thank God we're afterwards able to reestablish a tradition of praying there, but that was certainly shook up the status quo at that time. But wow, thank you for sharing that.
Rabbi,
yeah, no, it's an amazing story.
Can I say something? In the letters that David wrote home to his family while he was studying the yeshiva, one letter in particular he wrote to his parents about his neighbors and how they all got along beautifully. They shopped at the same pharmacy. They shopped at the same markets. They were kind to one another, and it was just an interesting letter in spite of what happened, because it did seem that there was a rabbi whose daughter had a wedding, and there were people from the entire village that were invited to the celebration. And he talked about how beautiful the wedding was and how nice it was to be so neighborly with his fellow Muslims. And so it's quite shocking to, you know, to read the other letters, of course, that follow the aftermath. So
yeah, there are different families there. Yeah. Different families there. Some of them have Jewish blood. Some of them are friendly to Jews. So, you know, it's never a monolithic type of thing. But when I was in Hebron many years ago, there were some kids who were spitting in our direction. We could palpably see some of the feelings that were there. But it's amazing how Jews are able to get around there anyway with their security. So, for instance, this Shabbos is Parshat Chayesara, the story of Sarah's purchase of the tomb, and you know, I don't know, hundreds of people will, I don't know about during COVID, but other than COVID, there would be hundreds of thousands of people who would come just for that special Shabbos.
So our author that is writing the story went last year and said that there were hundreds and hundreds of people sleeping on people's floors and camping out. And for this particular weekend, they make a pilgrimage for that reason. Yeah.
Yeah. I was too chicken to go, but some friends of mine went once. Amazing. How about you, Cindy? Anything you want to share with us?
I think what struck me the most was not so much the structure, the building, but the feeling that you, Rabbi, mentioned, where there's so much tension. I mean, we had to take an armored bus from Jerusalem. As you mentioned, it's a really short drive, but it took a long time because we had to get beyond the wall. And we had been on a bus for our whole trip, which was a few weeks, and this was at the end. And not everybody went that was part of our group, because some people were afraid just to go. And there was so much tension that, you know, not being familiar with that part of the world and not really having spent very, very much time and not really, frankly, having that many feelings about it or that much history of, you know, personal feelings and understanding, you could feel it. And it was so strong. And in addition to going to the building, the Tomb of the Machpelah and the grave, they also took us to a museum of the massacre. That was really, to me, that was the most memorable thing. And, you know, we had our parents, and we had our children, and we had our cousins, and I had done some research, and so I knew what we were about to see, and it wasn't going to be easy because, as you mentioned, you know, from the newspapers, there was murders and maiming, and there were some photographs explaining the massacre, and it was really very hard to see. And just the feeling of the heaviness and the tension, and knowing that our grandfather, who was Aaron David's brother, his little brother, looked for years for the grave and found it. And it was a very emotional time for him because he had looked and looked and looked and looked, and he finally found it, which is another story. And we got to go and see not the original grave because they were destroyed in the war, but we went to memorial, a second grave. And it was just a really moving moment for us. I appreciate my cousin Jill organizing the whole thing for us.
Really amazing. That's a good segue about the feeling and the hostility, a good segue to our final slide there. And I don't want to stymie any other family comments or any other comments, but I did want to just share with you one other slide, as I promised Shira before, but we get to that. we should mention that, yes, we talked about the double, and perhaps the double cave represents, you know, several caves. One fellow who claimed to have gone there, I don't know whether it's true or not, claimed that shaped something like this, that the caves are off from the circle. So I don't know whether that's accurate or not, but just another theory to think about. But there's an interesting midrash that there are three places bought with cash. One was Shechem, another very hostile city, and near Beit El, where there is a Jewish city. And the other is, and Jacob bought it with 100 casita, $100 in those days. The place of the temple in Jerusalem was bought from Arvana. He was a nice fellow. He was a good fellow. He was a friendly fellow. And then the half good, half bad fellow that Abraham bought Hebron from. So Hebron, Shechem, and Jerusalem, the three major cities going up and down the coast of Israel, they were bought by the patriarchs to show our connection to the land. And yet it's these places where the most hatred exists. Shechem, Nablus, very, very hardcore kind of a place. I'm sure a lot of good people there too, but it's known as a hostile kind of place against Jews. And then you have Hebron. Again, I'm sure a lot of good folks there, but a lot of tension, tremendous tension. It's palpable. And then Jerusalem, which of course the whole world has been fighting over for 2,000 years. And yet these are the places we bought. They're ours. We should note that it's a first. It's a starter city. It's the first city for Kalev, the first conquest of the spies, David's first city, and Avraham's first conquest in the land of Israel as well. And the Parsha says it over and again, all these three verses right here, over and again. He bought it for a fair price. He bought it in front of everybody. He bought it, no question about it. He bought it with full money. There's an idea that this is ours. And Avraham was trying to show that this is ours. And that's why a lot of these religious settlers are so focused on this. They say, what do you mean? This is the one place that we bought and we have a birthright to. This is our homeland. This is our family plot, not just your uncle, but you know, our great 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 grandfather. And that's why there's a lot of emotion from the Jewish side of why it needs to be our place. Of course, Arabs also are very connected, but to Abraham. But finally, there's this idea of Gan Eden, that if Abraham thought that his wife should be buried there and he's willing to spend a lot of money for it, it must be a good place to go to the next world. So there's all kinds of midrashim about this. And share one here. Adam said, meditating in his heart, he said, I know that death will remove me. Adam said, why am I alive? Let me build myself a grave. He dug and built a place for repose beyond Mount Moriah. Adam said, if in case of the tablets, just because of the future, they will be written in the finger of the Holy One.
I didn't know, maybe it's small talk.
He says, after my death, they will come and take my bones and make them into an image of an idolatry. Rather, I will put my coffin deep down beneath a cave and within a cave, right? That's why it's called the double cave. Adam put there with his, was put and his helper, Abraham and his helper, Isaac and his helper, it's an expression for your wife, Jacob and his helper, It therefore is called the Kiryat Arba, the four. The four, and there was story of the calf. Abraham ran to get the calf, but the calf fled before him and went to the cave of the Machpelah. Abraham went after it, and he found there Adam and his helper lying there in their beds. They slept, lights kindled above them, and the fine scent was about them, like a pleasing odor. Therefore, desired to have the cave of the Machpelah. There's an idea that somehow the cave of the patriarchs connects with the Gan Eden. It's the best entryway into Gan Eden. It's the best place to be buried, said Benjamin of Tudela, as you can get directly to heaven or to come back to earth after death. So there's this idea that there was this mystic sense that there was something special about it. But yeah, it's very tragic that it became this place of great tension. But of course, where there's something very valuable, that's where the passions are and the hatred and are flare much, much stronger. But yeah, it can be a very jarring thing to go, for instance, to Bethlehem and see the wall that we have there to make sure Jews could go to the tomb of Rachel. It's very jarring. So it's something to think about. It's disturbing, and yet it's heartwarming. It's disturbing that there's so much hatred. It's heartwarming that Jews are so dedicated to be able to willing to live there, and hundreds of people, you know, risk their lives, you know, go there and visit there and have the big weekend this coming Shabbos. And it's both scary, heartwarming, disturbing, all at once. But just picture a more idyllic world, which Aaron David Schoenberg experienced, a world in which there was a yeshiva there, and Jews and Arabs more or less were getting along. And so it was a world very so different from ours. So that's my presentation for tonight. It's a city that has a lot of connections, especially for the tribe of the Judeans. It's a city that has some sort of connection with the fours, or that the name of the main rabbi, the main person there was the main giant, his name was Four. It's a lot of different Jewish entities own it and connected to it. It may not be our best city, but it's still a beautiful city. And David and Avshalom, his son, felt that it was a good place to start. It was the capital city of Judea. And a lot of people, Benjamin Tudela and Rambam, had this sense that it was the best place to live, the best place to be, a very special experience to experience being there. I know I felt moved when I was there, although I was only there once or twice. Tragically, it's become such a tense place, but we hope that one day it will be a place of chevron, of chavirut, of connection. After all, the Jews and the Muslims, we share ancestor that lives there, and it should be a place of commonality, not of disparity. So those are my comments, but anyways, any other comments, whether some teams or others who want to comment, I welcome any comments, questions, or other stories about chevron.
Is that video on YouTube? I've seen.
Yeah, just type Chevron Caves. You'll find it.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes. That was great. Thanks.
Thanks. Anyone else? Okay. Jill, any last words?
Thank you. You're wonderful.
Well, I was going to tell you that I did.
I'm learning.
I did find learning. Portion of a letter, if you want me to read it, about what Aaron David, Uncle Dave is what we called him, said, and he was writing this letter to his mother, and it really wraps up what you were saying, Rabbi, about it being such a holy place. And he said, everything is golden brown and very deep green, and even though the sun is quite strong, as only the Oriental sun is, you are forced to remove your glasses by the sheer natural scenic beauty. And I tell you, in your wildest flight of imagination, you could not picture Palestine. And to crown your sensations, you are ever that you are treading on holy ground, that you are breathing holy air. This is, you say over and over again to yourself, is the land given as a divine gift to our ancestors. And
yeah, he was so inspired. It's amazing. I have a little inside story that the Engelberg fellow wanted to go also, but his mother said that, did I ever tell you this story? So his mother said that they couldn't afford it, but your ancestor was willing to pay for it, but but the Engelbergs didn't want to take the money. And he went on to become a big rabbi. I don't know. Do you think Aaron would have gone back to business or back to being a rabbi or something?
I think that he would have been a great scholar. I think he would have been a teacher. I don't know. What do you
think? He achieved so much. I mean, he went to Columbia.
Yeah.
He wasn't interested in business. He would have been I think he would have been a rabbi.
Yeah, or a rabbi, yeah.
I agree.
But he did start, he started the branches, but he started some sort of a wholesale thing. He had a stint in the business, right?
He did his best. He really, really wanted to make it work. He tried very hard.
Oh, okay.
But
okay.
He didn't have the heart for it.
It wasn't the passion. Right. Yeah. Beautiful. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us. And thank you, Jill, Lisa, and Cindy for joining us as well and sharing with us. And thank you all the students and participants joining us. Thank you, Joe, for joining us, everyone. This Thursday night, we have an interesting joint program with Baron Hirsch about 7 o'clock. And it's with Shammai Grossman and his wife, Sharon, talking about what do you do with the limited supply of vaccines. Tomorrow night, Wednesday night, I'll be talking about the Amida and understanding Amida. Welcome to join us for that. And usually our Chumash class is on Thursday night at 8 o'clock. Okay.
Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Thank you, everybody.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, sir.